The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Breaking tonight, Fox News has confirmed President Trump will nominate Amy Coney Barrett as the next Supreme Court Justice. She's from the 7th Circuit Court of Appeals. She would replace the late Justice Ginsburg, who died last week.
It is my profound honor to address the United Nations General Assembly. We must hold accountable the nation which unleashed this plague onto the world, China.
With a little more than a month to go before the U.S. presidential election, we're starting to get a lot of polls now in these highly competitive swing states. What we're seeing so far in the early results is that the race for the White House is much closer than a lot of the national surveys have been indicating all year.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
U.S. stocks finished higher on Friday in another volatile session, with the S&P 500 logging its fourth consecutive week of declines. Worries over new COVID infections, as well as signs that the global recovery is slowing, along with election uncertainty, weighed on investors' minds. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me this week is Tom McClellan. Tom thinks this is a normal election cycle correction that should end by the end of the month, with stocks powering higher over the next 6 to 8 months before reaching a top in his mind by April of next year. Also on the program, Mike McGlone from Bloomberg Commodities joins me as we focus on the strength in copper and the gold markets. Mike is very bullish on metals. Later on in the program, Chris Sheridan and I will discuss copper and why I believe it's the new gold. If you're thinking the green economy, well, green doesn't work without copper. I'll explain why I'm extremely bullish on copper and why it is worth an investment consideration. But before we do that, let's find out what moved this week's markets with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Thanks, Jim. It was an interesting week without any primary catalysts driving stocks or the market in general. If anything, I think there are three factors driving uncertainty, and those three factors are political landscape, resurgence of COVID in Europe, and the idea of this may be as good as it gets from the Fed. So concerning politics, we send a fond farewell to Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg and the achievements she made towards gender equality in her 27 years as justice, serving as the second woman on the court after Sandra Day O'Connor. You know, her absence leaves a void, and that will need to be filled, but introduces some political uncertainty as some officials will want to stall so soon in front of an election. Additionally, the added difficulty of voting in a Supreme Court justice will add to the uncertainty surrounding another coronavirus relief bill in Congress. Though there were reports this week that House Speaker Pelosi will introduce another $2.4 trillion relief bill, as that came later in the week. And of course, there's the elections, which will have a lot of importance on the economy, as both presidential candidates stand at opposite sides of the spectrum regarding taxes and finances. To sum up the political landscape and the effect on the market abhors uncertainty. That's the key. I continue to expect volatility and weakness until some of these issues are resolved, which may be a few weeks. Moving on, let's talk about some of the economic reports this week and then finish with some news highlights from the week. Existing home sales increased 2.4% in August, in a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 6 million, reflecting robust demand. The FHFA housing price index went up 1% for September, following a 1% rise in August. And mortgage applications are obviously on the rise. New home sales in August exceeded the seasonally adjusted annual rate of 1 million for the first time since November 2006, rising 4.8% month over month. Unemployment claims remain high, up slightly last week to 870,000. A year ago, they were 215,000. So still showing that not everybody's open, clearly. Durable goods orders increased 0.4% in August, following a revised increase of 11.7% in increase. So overall, strong economic data as manufacturing and home sales continue to recover. Some buy upgrades started to come in this week on some of the mega cap names that have been beaten up, which seemed to add to some stability. Apple had its price target raised Monday by Citigroup to $125 a share and that closed higher on the day, up 3%. Amazon was upgraded to outperform on Tuesday by AllianceBernstein, and the stock rallied 5.7% on the day. Separately, the financial sector has been under a lot of selling pressure as of late. Part of that is due to the reports of the movement of illicit funds, which we've been hearing now for about 2 weeks. Interestingly, Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo were upgraded later in the week. Johnson & Johnson reported their vaccine is entering phase 3 trials, but the news had no effect on the S&P 500 that day. And finally, let's finish off with the earnings winner this week. Nike had some high-flying airtime this week after reporting stellar results. Earnings per share almost doubled expectations, while revenue was mostly flat, but better than expected. They also increased their guidance on the full year for revenue, up high single to low double digits versus prior guidance that was flat for the year. Their success was mainly driven by online sales, which already hit their goal of 30% of sales, 3 years ahead of schedule. They've added new styles throughout the quarter, including their flagship Air series, Air Force One, Air Jordan One, and Air Max. Additionally, they've seen great success with a dedicated maternity collection of wear and Nike yoga collection for women, and that's been in development for 2 years. Nike called the response to its yoga collection amazing. This was a big win for Nike after its earnings missed last quarter. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. Political uncertainty, resurgence of COVID in Europe, and possibly peak Fed are reasons for continued weakness. Another reason is there's been no real leadership in stocks, no climax in selling pressure either. But hopefully our technician this week can shed more light on this sense of direction. Back to you, Jim.
Call Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together to create a better path to your financial future. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
We don't want recessions. We don't want corrections. Those corrections, they have been so important for centuries, with phases of creation followed by phases of correction, you know, creation, growth, but also correction, cleanup. We don't want that anymore. So we have created here a space where pressure and lack of adjustments have been accumulating and building up in several realms of society, not just monetary, not just consumer or investment. We have that everywhere. We even have in the military realm, something that is gonna pop up very soon. We have that in the geopolitical realm. We're following at least 12 crises on the geopolitical realm, and we are seeing that they are converging in this decade.
If you wanna listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
The stock market's been going back and forth, but it's mainly been heading down, which is typical around this time of the year. How serious is this? Well, let's find out. Joining me on the program is Tom McClellan from McClellan Oscillator. Tom, let's look at some of these moving averages. We got the Dow touching the 200-day. The NASDAQ and the S&P have broken through their 50-day moving averages, all within lines of, let's say, within that 10% correction range. So is this something we should be worried about, or is this just typical of what you see around this time of the year, and in particular in a presidential election year?
Jim, I would say that it is extremely typical, if something can ever be extremely typical. In the election year, the month of September typically sees the stock market or the S&P 500 top on September 3rd. This year it topped on September 2nd, so pretty darn close. And the whole month is typically down, not in a straight line, but in a stair step down. And we're doing that right on schedule. And in fact, we published a chart in our newsletter of the presidential cycle pattern, and the S&P 500's behavior looks almost exactly like it. So this is very typical. The market is due for a bottom on September 30th, normally, according to the presidential cycle pattern. This year, I think it might see a bottom on September 29th, because that's the date of the first presidential debate. And the outcome of that debate might give investors a little bit more certainty about what they think might happen. One of the big fears and the reason for a downward move in the September of an election year is the uncertainty of how the election is going to turn out. Even if people could handle either outcome, it's just the not knowing that makes people much more worried and puts their wallet on the hip, and they don't feel like going and spending money. And so that's why we see typical correction like we're seeing this year. It's very, very much according to how it normally behaves. But once people start having more certainty or thinking that they do, then we could see the stock market rallying once again. On average, the market is up in an election year. It's not up by as much as it is in the third year of a presidential term, but on average, it's up. If it's not up, that tends to be not very good news for the incumbent party. So if you remember back to the big bear market of 2008, John McCain was the incumbent party candidate running against Barack Obama, and it did not turn out well for John McCain because the market was down a lot that year. Generally speaking, though, if the market is up, that favors the incumbent party candidate. And so far, the market has been up this year with a big rogue wave in the middle of it. And so generally speaking, that favors President Trump's chances, although it's pretty iffy judging by the polls as they are this week.
Getting beyond September, do you expect that the market will be less volatile in the month of October because we have debates? We have, you know, it seems like the market gets more focused on who's going to be president the closer we get to the election, because up until this summer, nobody was paying much attention to anything.
That is true. People had a lot of other things to pay attention to this summer, but the election is going to dominate the news from here until November 3rd and for approximately 2 weeks after that, apparently, according to the recent court decision. So it'll be a big item to talk about. We're looking for continued volatility in October, but the sooner that people feel like they have a resolution for how the election is going to turn out, the sooner the market can get back to trending higher. And I do expect the market to trend higher all the way into April of next year. The election is just giving us a brief interruption of that.
So you expect this run to go into next year. And if we were taking out the crystal ball, what happens after that?
Well, after a big top in April, and I'm using capital letters calling it the top in April of next year, not good things are going to happen for the stock market. We have a big debt to pay from the COVID crash and from all the money that we spent on that. Whoever gets elected is going to get blamed for a bad economy over the next 4 years. That won't be his fault, but you know, whoever gets elected can make it better or worse than it's already going to be, but it's going to be pretty bad. And we know this from the message from crude oil prices. If you look at whatever crude oil prices do, you'll see that the stock market does the same thing about 10 years later. And so crude oil prices peaked in April of 2011. So on or about to April of 2021, we should expect the top for the stock market. But plus or minus, your mileage may vary. It depends on how badly the federal government screws things up. And if you want to make a bet about whether the federal government will screw things up, you should always bet on the screw up as opposed to the savior.
So as we look at this and, you know, I'm looking at the various sectors in the S&P, Tom, and what looks horrible is the breakdown of financials and energy. Could that portend maybe what happens next year?
That's going to be a factor, of course, but there's going to be other factors that matter more. The big demographic factor is that all of us baby boomers are reaching retirement age, and we all want to sell somebody our stock portfolios and our McMansions, but the echo boom generation, although it's quite big, they're not quite ready at age 30 to buy up all our stocks from us. And so all of us boomers are going to have to get used to the idea of accepting less for our stock portfolio than we were hoping we were going to get. We've all been thinking, oh, I'll just keep getting 8% returns forever and ever. It's not going to work that way when all of us try to squeeze through the exit door at the same time.
So the top next April, but from this point forward, maybe we go through a corrective phase here, but it should be up and away after that.
It should. And once we get resolution on how the election is going to turn out, whenever that resolution comes, then we can get back to trending higher. And it could be as soon as September 29th debate. It could be at some point in October. It could be a couple of weeks after the election in November, depending on how events turn out.
Now, you sent me three charts, and we're going to make these charts available to our listeners. The other one is the 10-year note minus the 3-year T-bill yield spread. What is that telling you?
Well, looking at the spread between just those two Treasury items is a way to model what the entire yield curve is doing. You know, you can't look at all possible maturities along the entire yield curve on one two-dimensional chart. So we're just looking at the spread between the 10-year and the 3-month, and it's a good representative of what the yield curve is doing. And the point is that, yes, the yield curve matters, but it matters in the distance. We applied a 15-month forward shift on that chart to show how whatever the yield curve is doing tells you what the GDP is going to be doing. And it, you have to wait for that 15-month lag time to go by. So the big COVID crash that we saw this year and the big drop in GDP growth, that just happened to match when the yield curve said it was going to happen, made it worse than it was already going to be. But the yield curve inverting 15 months prior was foretelling that things were going to be bad for the economy in 2020. And they sure enough got even worse than they were already going to be thanks to the COVID crash. But now we've thankfully had the Fed not keeping the yield curve inverted. We've got the long end slightly higher than the short end because the short end at zero. And so that says that in the next few quarters, looking out for at least the next 15 months, we should have a rebounding economy. And that's good news. Whether it'll be rebounding enough to keep anybody happy or to satisfy anyone, that's a different question. But at least the direction of the arrow should be upward.
One final question before we move to another chart you sent me. And that's the big sell-off that we've seen in some of the tech stocks. You have stocks like Apple that are down 20-something percent. Is this normally when you're in a bull market, you see sort of a rotation, one market or one sector gets blown out of proportion, everybody piles in, then all of a sudden somebody comes to the conclusion, hey, this is way too expensive, they bail out and they move someplace else. What's your take on tech here?
It comes down to a simple factor of beta. You know, beta is a description of how much one asset is going to move up or down relative to how much the market goes up and down. So if you had a stock with a beta of 1.0, then if the S&P 500 is up 5%, then that stock should be up 5%. If it's got a beta of less than one, like you think of for the old stodgy utility stocks that are going to be much calmer and you know much less exciting, then it'll move less. The tech stocks like Apple and Amazon and all the fangs, they have a beta well in excess of one, up around two to maybe three in some cases. And so what you're seeing with those is just a magnification, an amplification of what is happening in the overall market, which is the normal September correction in an election year. And they just are doing it louder and more because of beta. It's as simple as that.
So let's move on to a final chart you sent us, and that's gold, spot gold. And you've got the moving averages, and you've got a couple things going on there. The GLD trust in the ETFs with the price of gold. So what is this telling us?
Well, GLD is a gold exchange-traded note, or ETN, actually. It's not an ETF, it's an ETN, and the distinction, it doesn't really make any difference. GLD is one of them. IAU is the other one. It's an iShares version. If you take the combined assets of those two, it's a good look at what the retail crowd is thinking about gold. And normally what you'll see is that an up move in gold will get everybody excited, and they'll all pile into those two ETNs, and then a sell-off in gold will get everybody discouraged, and they'll all bail out, and the total assets of those two combined will go downward in a decline. What we're seeing now is different. What we're seeing now is gold dropped almost $200 an ounce, but people are still pouring money. All the buy the dippers are still pouring money into GLD and IAU, thinking, oh, what a great pullback the market's given me. What a wonderful opportunity I'm going to add to my position. That is a sign of excessive bullish sentiment toward gold. And you know what the market has to do to excessive bullish sentiment? That has to be punished. And the usual way that's done is by a big price move in the other direction that goes against what the crowd is thinking.
So as you look at this market, as we're concluding here, you feel we're following a typical presidential cycle where the market peaks maybe in the first couple days of September, and then it bottoms at the end of September. We're following that pattern. And once we get through that, maybe a little volatility in October, as we head to the November election, but from there forward all the way up to April of next year, you expect a good upward move in stocks.
I sure do. It should be a great 6 months once we know what the election outcome is going to be, and that could be any time between now and middle of November. We don't have to actually have the election results in order for investors to feel like they know how it's going to turn out. And that's the magic thing. Once investors feel that they know how the outcome is going to be, then the market can start trending higher.
And regarding the gold market, money is not selling. It's still pouring in. Is this the end of a bull market move for gold, or is this a corrective phase?
It's not going to be a really good opportunity to own gold right now. We've already got interest rates at zero, which has been a bullish factor. But interest rates are not going to go below zero if Jerome Powell has anything to do about it. So it can't get better. But it can get worse if interest rates start going higher. We're also in the 5-year downward phase of gold's 8-year cycle. And so having all the Fed stimulus in response to the COVID crash pushed gold up way higher than it ever should have gone, just because of throwing money at the banking system to try to rescue it. And gold was the beneficiary of that. Now, as we try to start remedying that and getting back more toward normal, gold has danced way up too high, and it's going to have to pay back the excesses. I'm not favorable on gold longer term. Someday I will be, but not right now. Look for a big cycle bottom in gold around 2025, and then a nice 3-year up phase after that is usually how that works. But this is not a great time to be a long-term holder in gold.
All right. So stay long stocks, at least for the next 6 months. Ignore the volatility. And if you had a favorite sector or one that really stands out or looks good to you, what is it?
I'd look at oil and energy more generally. It got beaten way down. Everybody stopped driving to work. Everybody stopped driving anywhere except to try to go stand in line at Costco to buy toilet paper. Now we're all caught up on our toilet paper purchases, and we're going to start driving more. And people are realizing that motorhomes might be a good way to do a vacation. So motorhome sales have been great. They're all going to burn gas. Eventually, gas prices are going to start recovering back again, and oil prices are going to go up again. And all of the companies that make money and make more money off of higher oil prices are likely to benefit. Oil tends to follow the movements of gold prices with about a 19-month lag. So if oil is going to see the echo of what gold has just done, that's extremely bullish for oil.
Super. Well, listen, Tom, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more of the work you do at McClellan Oscillator, tell them how they can do so and what they'll find there.
Best way is to visit our website, mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of the indicator, the McClellan Oscillator, that my parents developed back in 1969. My dad's still doing great. I just saw him for a couple of weeks earlier this month. He works with me on the newsletter and on our daily edition every day. Come visit our website. You can check out our free learning center, tons of articles there. And if you want the good stuff, you can check out our newsletter and our daily edition. We have samples there, and you can find out how to subscribe.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Tom. Stay safe and come back again.
Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Electrification of the drivetrain, the grid going green, all of that requires batteries, and batteries tend to be pretty nasty things in general. There was a study done a few years back that said that lead acid batteries are the number one and number three polluters in the planet. In the United States, North America, Europe, batteries are recycled responsibly. So we have smelters with scrubbers and the EPA standards and in OSHA inspections and all of this. And the same for Canada, same for Europe. But in 80% of the world, batteries are cracked open by hand. And sulfuric acid with lead particles in suspension runs into the groundwater. And then you have women and children walking around picking up this lead and putting it in open air crucibles for smelting. So the study that I'm referring to said that the cracking process is the number one creator of pollution in many of these countries.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
We'll be right back.
Well, outside precious metals, maybe copper, commodities have been in the doldrums. What is it going to take to give us a commodity bull market? Or is mainly this a rally in a bear market? Let's find out. Joining us is Mike McClone from Bloomberg. And Mike, you wrote an article relating the correlation of commodities to the stock market. I wonder if you might take some time and explain that for our listeners.
Yes. Hello, Jim. The correlation between the Bloomberg Commodity Index on a 12-month, 24-month basis is basically, and the S&P 500 is the highest ever. If you look at copper, you know, Dr. Copper, the metal known as the PhD in economics, its correlation on a 52-week basis with the NASDAQ is 0.8 or so, which is, you know, it doesn't get above one. And that's on a 52-week basis. So it's the highest ever. So to expound on what you said earlier, for commodities to continue to rally, typically in this case, one, correlations aren't this high, you need the stock market to continue to advance. Although we're seeing some signs of a bit of divergent strength in commodities. For example, the key one, as I mentioned, copper is still hovering above $3 a pound on the CME traded copper. And that's up about 9% in the year versus the S&P 500. It's basically unchanged. So that's showing a little bit of sign of divergent strength. That's a really good sign for commodities, but it's really more related to it's a metal. And it's the key issue for commodities typically is crude oil. It's the world's most significant. And to answer your first question, that's still in an extended bear market. And I don't expect that to come out of it very soon. So we're seeing different commodities go different ways. But my focus going forward really is the metals, and that is gold, copper, silver, platinum, palladium, and the base metals.
And as we look at that, let's talk a bit about copper, because it's my understanding the inventories of copper in London have been falling. Chinese imports have been increasing. And China's economy is doing much better than most people thought. What influence is that having on commodities and especially copper?
Well, you nailed the key reasons why copper's been bouncing. The issue is inventories are very much manipulated by who knows who. And what China's been doing is they've been restocking in copper, restocking in crude oil. Virtually every country in the world has been. Like the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve has been, they've been adding to it. But the key issue for copper historically is really not inventories, because they actually have a positive correlation with prices, i.e. when inventories are rising, it's usually thought people usually use it as a negative. But if you look at it factually, it's really more GDP growth, economic demand out of China, and supply out of South America. So that's been a key issue lately. There's been a little bit of a drop in supply out of South America. China's restocking. Right now, I'm impressed. I'm going to give it a little more time to get bullish on copper, because I'm still worried about the U.S. stock market, but it's going the right way. It's showing divergent strength. But the big picture for commodities typically is crude oil. And the big difference is copper has limited supply. And this paradigm shift we're seeing in rapidly advancing technology is not increasing supply, but it's increasing demand, i.e. Everybody needs to use electricity for cars and for solar panels and silver more there, but for everything. But in terms of the most significant commodity, crude oil, rapidly advancing technology is increasing supply and decreasing demand. That's why I kind of wrote back to the metals. In the big picture, metals are favored to continue to appreciate.
You know, Mike, it seems when it comes to energy, it's just been a perfect storm. If it wasn't economic weakness, it was American fracking, it was oversupply, and then on top of that, you get COVID, which has really bit into the demand for energy. I don't think I've seen anything like this in the last two or three decades, where you've had demand fall off this steeply when it comes to oil.
Well, that's the key point. It has fallen off steeply. Prices have adjusted accordingly. So supply has reacted to that. But look at the big picture for crude oil. It peaked at $145 in 2008 during the last financial crisis. And here we are, WTI is around 39. So that's classic deflation. And a lot of that is demographic shifts, but most of it is rapidly advancing technology, increase in supply in the most significant country in the world for demand, which it used to be the U.S. Now, the U.S. became a net exporter last year. So the key point is, even before COVID, the trends in supply and demand were unfavorable for WTI. So what I like to ask myself, I was bearish crude oil before the year started and before COVID, should I be bullish now because prices have dropped 36%? I don't think so yet, because every day that goes by in crude oil, people like me buy more electric cars, and we use solar panels on our homes, and the technology is working against it. So that's where I think in the big picture, you're going to get spikes initially. You need to have, but you basically need some kind of supply shock, like unfortunately a war in the Gulf or something for crude oil to really sustain higher prices, because demand is not the way it used to be and it probably never will be. A good example, good statistic for that is U.S. total liquid fuel consumption in this country is about the same as it was 20 years ago. In history, that's never happened because of GDP has increased so much. It's never happened. That is, we're just increasing our GDP and we're not using more liquid fuels because we don't need it as much, more efficient. And a good example is I came from a bit of a farming background, and we get a lot of our unleaded gas in this country from corn nowadays. That's just something we didn't do 20 years ago.
So, Mike, let's talk about technology and its impact on two specific commodities. So as you and I in the country move more towards electric cars, my house is solar powered and soon to have an electric car, that's going to create more demand for copper because there's a lot of copper that goes in the electric cars. At the same time, if I'm driving an electric car, I'm not buying gasoline, so there's less demand for gasoline. So let's talk about this technology impacting two commodities.
That's the key factor. That's why we should see continued pressure downward in gasoline prices and I would say crude oil, and continued strength and continued tailwinds for higher copper, silver, cobalt, base metals, and gold's included in that because of those shifts. And the way I like to ask ourselves, like you said, you're going to be an electric car soon. I've had mine for a while. I love my solar panels. I can't wait to get another electric car. And we all know this is where it's going unless we expect technology to reverse. And we all know what technology usually does. It continues to advance exponentially. So it's just a matter of time. That's why I look at it from an investor standpoint. Focus on the metals. It's really difficult to invest in copper. You can buy miners, which is more equities, but then it's much easier to buy the like silver, platinum, palladium, gold. And those are easy to get exposure through ETFs, which I won't go into. But from an investor standpoint, it's easier. And if you're looking at things like the base metals and exposure for that, it's really more equities that track the base metals, because there's really no ETFs that track directly to most of the base metals like copper, aluminum, cobalt, nickel, and zinc.
Yeah. And what about things like nickel, where you have Elon Musk basically making a pitch to mining companies, go out and mine this stuff, I'll sign a 10-year contract.
Yes. Well, the thing about the nickel prices, it's on its way up. It's been recovering, but it was much lower a long time ago. And nickel right now is around $14,000 a metric ton. I peaked, I think it was around 40,000 a metric ton about 10 years ago. So it's got a room to move higher. It's just harder to invest in. So for investors, maybe focus more on the miners who produce these metals. But that's the kind of lowdown in nickel. I think nickel is going to continue to appreciate. But when Elon Musk says that's the key thing, when he suggests people should produce more of it, they can and they will. And the best way to bring on supply is prices. And that's really elastic in crude oil. You get, prices go up, U.S. producers just can produce a lot more of it right away. But it's less elastic in metals, i.e. you just can't produce more of it right away.
You know, the amazing thing, Mike, you and I are talking about technology, its impact on commodities. But, we think of all this technology, whether it's our iPads, it's our iPhones, our iWatch, solar panels, all of this technology still requires base metals. I mean, to make that electric car, you're going to have nickel for batteries. You're going to have copper. So we still use the raw materials from the earth to make all this stuff in this technological society we live in.
Exactly true. And that's why my focus has been for about the last few years and looking forward to the next decade or so from a commodity standpoint, focus on the metals for appreciation. Broad commodities, I don't know so much, and it's harder to invest in. But yes, the metals are where I really see our future as far as prices appreciation, more demand. Most of them will probably follow palladium. Palladium was at all-time new highs recently. And gold's part of that, but also it's part of the dollar situation. One thing about metals is they're all based in U.S. dollars. And if the dollar is depreciating, and if all paper currencies are depreciating, the metals stand to be the best beneficiaries. The two key beneficiaries in history are gold and copper. Typically, they trade the best when the dollar declines. And that's how you measure the dollar. You measure it versus other countries, other currencies. But one good way to measure dollars versus metals, because those are, you know, measuring dollar versus paper versus measuring dollar versus physical assets like we, you know, are talking about the metals.
Speaking of metals, let's talk about gold for a minute. I mean, it's inversely correlated with the dollar. Given where you think the dollar might be going over the next decade, if you look at this gold bull market, we had a nice run in the 00 decade, the reverse in the last decade. Let's talk about gold now and going forward.
Yeah, so gold's been basically unchanged on a decade basis, which to me is really enhances its value for the next decade. And it's notably compared to the stock market, which is up a lot on a decade basis. So I see gold as most notably appreciating. And the key thing is it's been showing divergent strength versus the dollar. So it's up on a two-year basis. It's recovered. 2 years, gold's up about 58-60%. Yet the broad dollar index, this is a Federal Reserve measure of the broad trade-weighted dollar, is basically up slightly. So the dollar, despite the strong dollar, I mean gold, despite the strong dollar, has been advancing. So I think that's going to continue. And a key bottom line support for gold is increasing quantitative easing, increasing debt to GDP ratios. Now, I don't really see an end in sight. Even the Fed says they don't see an end in sight to increasing quantitative easing. But a key factor that can really push more of that on the market, encourage more QE, is if the stock market, it doesn't have to go down, but if it stops going up or it enters some kind of a bear market. So here's my point. Gold and the price of gold, and doesn't really matter to the stock market, but if the stock market just stops its appreciation that it has been or actually starts to decline, that'll kick in more QE and that'll support the price of gold. So I'm quite bullish for the relative value of gold versus the stock market going forward for the next 5 to 10 years.
What about silver?
Very similar. Silver considered leveraged gold, typically historically. If the dollar is weakening, silver will on average rally about 1.5 times the price of gold. But one thing about silver, it doesn't have that limited supply. It has more demand through solar, but you can bring on silver supply quite easily. It can be up, jump 10% in a year from miners. Gold, you cannot, have never been able to do that. And silver is looking attractive, but it needs a global economic demand growth. But overall, silver, I view, as should do well with gold and copper. It's just been a little bit reluctant to lately, but I'm bullish on silver. It just has a little less, it's more dependent on global economic demand growth. But the key point we talked about earlier is this demand from EVs and the new economy is quite good for silver. It's just not as constrained in terms of supply that gold is.
So when you look at all this going forward, it looks like focus on the metals seems to be the one bright spot in commodities. Oil, not so much, and who knows about the ag sector. The only thing we know is there's more people being born each year. So how would you play this, Mike? Would you go in like a commodity ETF, like copper or silver or gold, or would you go with the miners?
I think most of the above. There's ETFs that track the precious metals. They're the most notable, most fluid. They're actually the biggest commodity ETFs. There's broad market commodity ETFs, and that depends on what your actual investor is looking for. But I think metals have the best upside. There's really no copper ETFs, and directly, so there's precious metals ETFs, gold, silver, platinum, palladium. Those are quite liquid and fluid. And then the miners. The miners should do well. Historically, when gold has outperformed the equity market, the gold miners and the equity and the metals miners have done quite well. So miners get that exposure.
As we close, if our listeners want to follow the work that you do at Bloomberg, how could they do so?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. You can link in with me and happy to do that. I publish my things there, and people, they can link in with me. I'm also on Twitter, Mike McGlone 11. And so happy to connect with anybody. I just oftentimes I'll focus on publish things. I just don't always respond. But happy to be in touch with anybody who wants to reach out.
All right. Well, listen, Mike, as always, thanks for coming on the program. All the best. Stay safe and come back again.
We have not changed the timeline, even in the wake of COVID. We still think this will come sometime around 2030. Now, many of our clients have asked us, is this the Great Depression? Or are we just getting it early because COVID triggered it? And we really don't think so. We think this is just a regular, you know, kind of bump in the road. We think of COVID much more as a natural disaster than a really economically driven event, a cycle. So looking forward to 2030, COVID doesn't change the timing. Really, what it does is it makes it that much more likely. One of the driving factors behind that outlook is just the amount of debt that the U.S. has taken on.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. Well, in today's big picture, we're going to talk about copper, the new green gold. Why is that? And where does copper fit into investors' portfolios, especially for those that are interested in the commodity sector? Well, that's what we're going to discuss today. So, Jim, kick things off for us and tell us, why is copper so important in today's environment?
If you think of copper, you probably think of plumbing. Maybe you're thinking of copper wiring. You know, Chris, copper is probably one of the earliest metals that we have in recorded history. I mean, it goes all the way back to about 5500 BC, and where copper was used in coins, ornaments, and then combined with tin, it gave us the Bronze Age. So we've been using copper either to make weapons, to use it for industrial uses. We've been doing that for centuries. But if you really think about copper, it's an industrial metal, but more than anything else, it is the essential key metal for this green economy that we're talking about moving towards. This week, the governor of the state of California said that beginning in 2035, you will no longer be able to sell combustion engines in California. So meaning that all cars are going to have to be green going forward. And when you think about things that are green, you think about electric vehicles, you think about, you know, going solar, wind turbines, all the things that make up this green economy. Well, what we forget about is part of what makes this green economy is copper. So think of electric vehicles, think of cars. Think of household appliances, smartphones, electric cables, plumbing. This whole green economy, a lot of the things that you have, whether it's tablets, smartphones, EV vehicles, a lot of this is all made with one essential ingredient, which is copper. In fact, in addition to copper, with this new green environment, is also the metal nickel. You had Elon Musk coming out recently saying basically, hey, if you're a mining company, go out and mine nickel. We'll sign a 10-year exclusive agreement with you because if they want to make batteries, they're going to need nickel.
We actually just spoke with a guest on FS Insider this week. And one of the interesting things that he pointed out is that batteries are very unfriendly to the environment. There's a lot of pollutants and chemicals that go into them. He talked about how lead batteries in particular, which are some of the older ones, how those are some of the most contributing pollutants to various areas. And so they've developed a battery that is much more environmentally friendly, that uses a lot of nickel and elements that essentially are inert, that you know, they can put in a landfill. That's not the case with a lot of older batteries. So this is an important part, of course, of the modern electrical economy that we're moving into.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you think about how we use copper today, about 43% of consumption of copper is building, construction, think plumbing, wiring in your home, electrical and electronics, about 19%, transportation, 19%, consumer products, 12%, and machinery, 7%. The area that is going to grow more rapidly, and that's the transportation sector. Currently, it's about 19%. If we keep growing in terms of EVs, you could see that figure double, Chris, because right now, the world is consuming 24 million tons per year. And right now, we are on the verge of a copper squeeze. You've got China's insatiable demand. now that China's economy is growing again, and there's evidence mounting on the London Exchange where inventory levels, Chris, are the lowest that they've been in about 15 years. So if we take a new demand already and pile it on top of existing demand, you're talking about a key demand cycle that's building for copper. We could see copper get back to prices that we saw in 2011, where copper got up to over $10,000 for almost a metric ton. But if you take a look at, for example, the EV market, the average American car has about 9/10 of a mile, or roughly about 44 to almost 100 pounds of copper between a small, large car or a hybrid. If you take a look at what happens with EVs, that figure gets even bigger. So, I mean, if you take a look at where we're going with EVs, it's estimated by 2026, annual sales of electric vehicles will approach $1 trillion for the first time in history. If you take a look at the top 10 car companies, they're all working on EVs, with several of them, Volkswagen to Volvo, announcing they will phase out combustion engines.
The competition is really heating up. I mean, there are a number of car manufacturers that are gearing up on releasing electric vehicles. Ford is working on electric truck. There's a number of other car manufacturers. So as you said, you know, copper, nickel, if the batteries, a lot of these essential raw materials, these resources are needed in heavy demand if that's what they're going to be doing. So, you know, what's your take on some of the competition that Tesla is facing from some of these other manufacturers?
Yeah, when you think of EVs, you think of Tesla, and their market cap is worth more than the entire auto industry. But if you take a look at what's going on in Germany, by the time this is all done, probably the largest EV car maker in the world is going to end up being Volkswagen. And, you know, Tesla is trying to rev up. They made 375,000 vehicles. They want to go to 500,000 vehicles here shortly. But Chris, if we just take a look at last year, there were 2.1 million EV sales for 2019. It's a 40% year-over-year change. I mean, it's really growing exponentially. And if you take a look at these big EV vehicles, they use about 180 pounds of copper in every vehicle. So if we take Tesla, which wants to go to 500,000 vehicles a year, that's an additional 45,000 tons of copper just for Tesla alone. And the other thing that we think of, you know, we've had this gravitation to the Southwest, areas that are growing rapidly, Texas, Florida, places like Arizona. Well, you know, places that have this heat because of weather, they use air conditioners. Well, every air conditioner has 3 pounds of copper in it. So the more that we move to these arid desert climates here, not only in the United States, but elsewhere in the world, that's more air conditioners. So in fact, it was amazing because the new CEO of Barrick came out and said that copper is the new strategic metal. And you have several large companies, whether you're looking at BHP, whether you're looking at Barrick, they're looking to get into the copper space and the nickel space, Chris, because they see this green revolution that's taking place, which is only going to increase further demand for copper. The problem is we've got the economy starting to gear up. We've got China's economy taking off. China is buying copper like crazy. So we've got low levels of inventory. We could actually see a squeeze here and a spike and see copper go to levels that we haven't seen. In fact, many long-term forecasts are calling for copper by the end of the next decade, going from where it is today, just slightly over $3 a pound, to actually going up to as high as $8 a pound. Because as we transition from gas combustion engines to electric vehicles, and remember, it's not just the cars that you're going to drive, it's going to be the pickup trucks, it's going to be the semi-trucks with companies like Nikola that are coming out with, let's say, hydrogen fuel cell battery trucks. It's transportation. It could be eventually trains and eventually ships. And it was amazing because I love to sail. And one of the things that I've noticed that's an option now to get on a sailboat is you can opt for an electric engine instead of a diesel engine. So all this EV wave, this electrical wave that we're seeing in the transportation system, Chris, it's going to be across the board. It's going to be cars. It's going to be trucks. It's going to be vans. Who knows? We may even see it in the RV space. It's already getting into the sailboat space. And how long before it gets into the, let's say, the motor yacht space?
Yeah, and if you're also talking about not just electric vehicles for people that are using, I mean, cars and trucks, but if we're now moving into actual semi-trucks, I'm not sure, but I would assume that there's quite a bit more copper used in those than your normal vehicle, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think of it. I mean, if there's 180 pounds of copper in a Tesla, imagine the number of pounds in a semi-truck or a van or, even things like semi-trucks, and eventually we may see them in trains, we may see them in ships. I mean, where are we seeing them? In sailboats. So how much longer before we're seeing electric ships, electric sailboats, electric motor yachts? So it's going to permeate and pervade and become ubiquitous in the transportation system. And right now, transportation is only 19% of copper use versus about 43% for construction. So look for copper demand in the transportation space to more than double in this decade.
Now, I'm looking at a chart of copper prices, and copper's done extremely well since we saw the bottom back in March. They've climbed pretty steadily, and I believe copper has outperformed a lot of other, raw materials out there. And as you noted, China has been buying massive amounts of copper. We actually posted a chart of this and discussed this in a recent video that we posted on our website, just showing copper imports to China. They've surged to an all-time record high, more than what we were seeing even during 2011 when they were also on a buying spree of cement and all sorts of different raw materials. So question is, do you think that copper has gotten a little bit extended here just when you look at the rate of imports into China and some of the sentiment on copper? Would you be looking for pullback, or how would you play that in terms of investments?
Well, if you look at a chart, it's finally broken out above $3. So I expect the price of copper to get stronger going forward. I mean, EV sales are not going to stop this year. They're going to be up this year, and they're going to increase every single year. You take a look at another market that's doing well right now, and that's real estate construction. I mean, builders can't build homes fast enough in places like Nevada, Arizona, where you're seeing this big migration wave out of high-tax states like our own state of California. So think of construction and real estate. Think of EV sales. And more importantly, Chris, the other side of this is if this demand is growing as fast as it is and is going to accelerate as more and more governments, like my own state of California, basically saying, you're not going to be able to drive a semi-truck in this state in 10 years. And in 15 years, you're not going to be able to buy a gas combustion engine. So we're moving in this direction. And of course, if we're going to be going towards EV, the other side of that is where are we going to get the electrical power in the grid to drive the electricity? Because instead of coming home after work, you pull your car in the garage, turn the engine off, there's no demand on power. Well, that's going to change, because if everybody starts moving to an EV, you're going to pull that car into the garage and you're going to plug it in to charge it overnight. So normally when demand goes down at night on the grid system, demand is going to increasingly be rising because more and more people will be charging their cars at night. So Chris, I just see the demand growing exponentially for copper here in this decade as a result of this new green economy that we're moving in. I mean, you want to think transportation? Think EVs.
Okay, so from a fundamental perspective, the supply-demand picture you think is favorable. There's some pretty significant support around the $3 area there. That's above the high that we saw late last year. You think the long-term factors are favorable for copper as well. Anything else that you're looking at in terms of copper, if people are listening now, thinking about investing in it?
Well, you know, my favorite is investing in producers. In fact, the largest percentage of my portfolio is copper. In fact, I'm all in. But there's two ways you can do it. You can buy the actual industrial metal through an ETF, or you could buy copper producers. I like copper producers because I think a lot of them are going to be acquired. Because the other side of this equation on demand, there's been no major copper discoveries in the U.S. over the last several decades, and only a very handful, a few of them, if you look globally. So the other thing that's happening is the existing copper mines that are in production is we're seeing deteriorating grades of existing mines in operation around the globe. In other words, the percentage of copper that they're extracting per ton of ore is less and less. So it's kind of like almost like depletion in oil. The ore grades, the rich copper zones have been traditionally mined, and there's only a handful of rich copper mines around the globe. So a lot of companies, whether they're BHP, whether it's Barrick, are going to be out looking to acquire copper. And the reason I think they're going to acquire it is it takes almost 10 years to make a discovery, put in the infrastructure, bring a mine, get the permit. It almost takes 10 years to do that. Well, we're going to have a huge demand in this decade that's going to come in. You can't very well fulfill that by going out and saying, all right, we're going to go out and try to make a discovery, because a discovery can take a minimum 7 to 10 years from the time of discovery to the time it's actually brought into production. So I think the best way to do mining is on Wall Street, and I think that's what a lot of these big companies are going to end up doing. You've got Barrick saying they're looking to acquire copper. You've got BHP, which is divesting itself of its coal properties, and they are on the acquisition for copper and nickel. So more and more of this is going to go in this area. So I would be buying the producers because I think that's where the money's going to be made.
Many times in this high-tech world that we live in, especially when you think about, you know, just the big tech companies and everything's all about big data and AI these days, well, there's also a massive and growing infrastructure to support that. That requires cables, it requires copper, and we do need raw materials. And so again, as we discussed in today's podcast, copper is the new green gold. Jim, with that said, what would be the best way for our listeners to get in touch with us, to speak with our advisors, our wealth managers, in terms of how to invest in copper and what we're doing for clients at Financial Sense Wealth Management along these lines?
They can call us at 888 toll-free, 888-486-3939, and our advisors would be glad to talk to you about a lot of the things that we see unfolding in this next decade. I tell you, Chris, we're excited about what we see unfolding in this next decade. It's going to be to commodities what the previous decade or the OO decade was, and people just don't see it. It's right there in front of us, and people are overlooking it. They're thinking of technology. They're thinking of Tesla. Well, you know what they're not thinking of? Tesla needs nickel. Tesla needs copper. EVs need copper. They're not thinking of what goes in to make this happen. Do your own research, but we think it's a promising metal going forward in this decade. And it's not just us. The big guys are out shopping for copper. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, stay safe and have a pleasant weekend.
Don't forget to tell your friends and family about Financial Sense News Hour and the wide range of guest experts, investment strategists, and book authors that we speak with on a regular basis, some of the top thinkers in the industry. Again, we do have a weekday premium program as well called FS Insider. If you're not already a subscriber and you would like to listen to more of our podcasts during the week, it can also be accessed on our website or through a podcast app of your choice on a mobile device. If you're not already a subscriber, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.